ever wondered about the brilliant minds behind, you know, truly original, category-defying entertainment? The kind of genius that doesn't just create a show, but a whole new way of watching. Today, we're diving deep into someone whose creative journey is as unique and, well, inventive as the world he's built. We're talking about Joel Hodgson, a name that for many of us is just synonymous with innovation, cult classics, and a very particular, often surreal brand of humor. He's the visionary behind one of Time Magazine's top 100 television shows of all time, right? A creator who consistently pushes boundaries and reinvents himself, leaving this indelible mark on comedy and pop culture.
Absolutely. And our mission today really is to unpack the fascinating career of Joel Hodgson. We want to offer you a kind of shortcut to understanding the multifaceted nature of his ingenuity. We'll trace his path from, believe it or not, a magician ventriloquist in the heart of Wisconsin through his stand-up comedy days to becoming a television pioneer and, I think, a master of creative reinvention. We'll explore the foundational influences that shaped him, the challenges he navigated, you know, things like creative control battles, stepping away from the spotlight, and the enduring legacy of his work. And we'll always be connecting back to why his approach continues to resonate so deeply with audiences even now.
Right. And we've got a fantastic stack of sources for this deep dive. We're covering everything from his early life and influences, his kind of meteoric rise in stand-up, the genesis and remarkable evolution of his most famous creation, Mystery Science Theater 3000, and his many, many projects in between and beyond. So settle in, because you're about to uncover some surprising facts and experience those genuine aha moments, you know, the ones that really connect the dots in his truly one-of-a-kind career, revealing the deliberate thought behind what often appears to be just pure, joyful absurdity. Okay, let's unpack this and start right at the beginning. Let's trace Joel's creative lineage. What shaped a mind like Joel Hodgson's right from the start? Our sources tell us Joel Gordon Hodgson was born February 20, 1960, Stevens Point, Wisconsin. He grew up living with his family in Green Bay and Fort Atkinson, also in Wisconsin. So you get this quintessential Midwestern backdrop to his formative years. But it wasn't just the geography that was formative. Our sources highlight a very specific upbringing, an evangelical Christian household.
Mm-hmm. And what's really fascinating here is how his church's shows profoundly influenced his desire to become an entertainer. This wasn't just like passive observation of Sunday services. It suggests an early and active exposure to performance and storytelling within a community setting. Think about the nature of these shows. They were often, you know, elaborate productions with costumes, sets, a clear narrative purpose, all designed to engage and connect with an audience, conveying a message with both sincerity and often a touch of accessible humor. That kind of environment can be a really powerful and foundational catalyst for creative development. It teaches not just the mechanics of entertainment, like timing, stage presence, how to construct a narrative, but also the importance of connecting directly and emotionally with people, all while maintaining a distinct point of view. It's not just about putting on a show, it's about fostering a particular type of engagement. And that profoundly echoes in his later work, doesn't it?
It really does. So given this early exposure, what were his very first steps into performing? He actually began performing as a magician and ventriloquist way back in seventh grade. Can you believe that? Doing local events in Green Bay, honing his craft even then, juggling school at Ashwaubenon High School with these burgeoning performances. This wasn't just a fleeting hobby for a young kid. It's an early and clear indication of a burgeoning talent, a dedication to practice, and a palpable drive to entertain. He was learning to command attention, to build a world on a small stage, and to surprise an audience. All crucial skills he'd master later on.
That foundational period, performing magic and ventriloquism locally, it's absolutely crucial for understanding his unique trajectory. I mean, really. It provided him with hands-on experience in charming an audience, manipulating props, creating illusion skills that would become incredibly significant and visibly present later in his career, especially with his most famous creations, you know. After high school, Hodgson continued to pursue this path. He headed to Bethel University in Arden Hills, Minnesota, to formally study theater and mass media. And this move to a formal academic study is critical because it allowed him to merge his innate performing talent and practical experience with a more rigorous intellectual understanding of storytelling and performance. It was where his raw talent met, sort of theoretical frameworks.
Yeah, exactly. And it was at Bethel that he really started developing his signature blend, the one that would set him apart. He further developed his magic act by, like, ingeniously adding comedy, performing for musical acts, coffee houses, comedy clubs around the area. This blend of magic and comedy, this precise combination of illusion and laughter, it really starts to become a signature of his style. It's a way of subverting expectations and finding humor in the unexpected. He was crafting a unique voice, not just performing tricks.
Indeed. And this isn't just about adding a few jokes to a magic trick, right? It's about integrating two distinct performance styles into a cohesive, more engaging act that uses both wonder and wit. But here's where it truly deepens our understanding of his comedic mind. Our sources cite a Theater of the Absurd class at Bethel, taught by a Dr. David Horn, for helping him, quote, crystallize the meaning of his comedy. Mm. Now, if we connect this to the bigger picture, understanding the deeper philosophical underpinnings of his humor, especially through the intellectual lens of absurdism, it really explains the unique, often surreal tone and the intellectual underpinnings of his later work.
Okay, like how? Can you give an example?
Sure. For instance, the very premise of Mystery Science Theater 3000, right? Being trapped in space, forced to watch bad movies by an evil scientist. A seemingly meaningless and inescapable situation that's inherently absurd. But rather than just lamenting it, Joel's characters, and by extension the show's humor, they embrace the ridiculousness. They transform a passive, torturous experience into active, critical, and shared comedic engagement. It's a comedic response to a meaningless situation, a very absurdist perspective that finds joy and connection in the face of the nonsensical.
Okay. I see that now.
Yeah. This framework allowed him to create humor that wasn't just slapstick, but derived from an intelligent, often philosophical, confrontation with the mundane and the ridiculous. This isn't just a series of disconnected jokes. There's an intentional philosophical approach, a way of looking at the inherent ridiculousness of existence that just permeates his creations.
And his talent, this unique blend of magic, ventriloquism, and that absurdist comedy, it was clearly recognized early on. He won the Campus Comedy Contest in 1981, and then the first annual Twin Cities Comedy Invitational in 1982. These weren't just local accolades. They were clear indicators that he was gaining significant recognition and had a unique appeal that resonated far beyond just a university setting. He was definitely ready for a bigger stage.
Absolutely. Those early contest wins were critical validation. They signaled that he had something truly special and, frankly, marketable. By November 1982, at the remarkably young age of 22, he made that pivotal move to Los Angeles, a clear, ambitious step toward the professional comedy circuit. He quickly became a regular performer at iconic venues like the Comedy Store in West Hollywood, a legendary proving ground, the Magic Castle in Hollywood, nodding to his magic roots, and the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach. These weren't just any stages. These were the competitive proving grounds for top comedic talent, where careers were forged and where you really had to sink or swim, performing nightly alongside the best in the business.
And talk about a big break. His talent didn't go unnoticed for long. He was spotted by Late Night with David Letterman producer Barry Sand at the Comedy and Magic Club.
Right, Barry Sand.
Leading to his network television debut just 3 months later. That's an incredibly rapid ascent, isn't it?
It's lightning fast.
From local clubs to national television. He then made 4 other appearances on Letterman, becoming a recurring favorite, and 4 on Saturday Night Live as a guest act, showcasing his unique blend of magic and comedy. And not only that, he was featured on HBO's 8th annual Young Comedian special, sharing the stage with names that would soon become household legends, people like Bill Maher, Paula Poundstone, and the beloved John Candy.
Yeah, that HBO special was a huge deal. This early and rapid success on such major national platforms, Letterman, SNL, HBO, it unequivocally shows his immense talent and unique appeal. He was quickly recognized as a rising star, showcasing his ability to connect with a broad national audience almost immediately. Which makes you wonder, what exactly makes a comedian stand out enough to catch the discerning eye of a Letterman producer in such a crowded and fiercely competitive field?
Good question.
Well, his distinctive blend of magic, ventriloquism, and that specific brand of absurd comedy, honed in those early Wisconsin days and refined at Bethel, it certainly set him apart from the pack. He wasn't just another stand-up telling jokes. He was performing an integrated, multifaceted act, a kind of theatrical experience infused with an intelligent, unique humor.
He continued working at the Comedy Store while also touring cities across the country, San Jose, San Francisco, Detroit, Kansas City, Minneapolis. He was really on a roll, seemingly on the fast track to mainstream stardom. But then in 1985, after such a meteoric rise, Joel made a truly surprising decision. He left stand-up. Citing a need for a creative sabbatical, he moved back to Minneapolis.
Oh, a real curveball.
A true creative, always following his muse, even if it meant stepping away from what looked like surefire success. So after this really meteoric rise in the stand-up comedy world, Joel makes this, well, pretty surprising move. In 1985, he steps away from the national spotlight for what he called a creative sabbatical. For someone who was like right on the cusp of mainstream stardom, what exactly does that mean? It certainly wasn't a break from creativity.
No, not at all.
In fact, it seems to have been quite the opposite.
What's truly fascinating here is that this period between 84 and 88, which he later called his official return to comedy, it wasn't a pause. It was more like a profound incubation period. He didn't just sit still or disappear. He actively diversified his skills in ways that would become foundational for his later work. During this time, he engaged in this incredibly diverse array of creative pursuits. He built and sold sculptures, which showcases a real hands-on artistic sensibility. He worked at a t-shirt factory, you know, understanding practical production. He designed toys, which speaks directly to his inventive and playful nature. And crucially, he began designing and building props, including those iconic robots, for other comedians.
Wow. So building robots for other people even then?
Exactly. These diverse activities, they directly speak to his innate inventiveness and hands-on creativity. It demonstrates a deep curiosity that extended far beyond just performing. It was about bringing ideas into tangible physical form. This period of exploration cultivated his unique ability to merge physical craftsmanship with a very specific comedic vision. It fostered skills that would become absolutely essential for his future endeavors. He wasn't waiting for the perfect role. He was basically building the foundation for what was to come, brick by creative brick, piece by ingenious piece.
And this wasn't just a period of like personal skill development and isolation. He was still making waves in the industry, even off the stand-up stage. He even co-wrote an HBO special with none other than Jerry Seinfeld in 1986. That speaks volumes about the continued respect for his writing talent.
Huge deal, yeah.
And here's another intriguing what-if moment. He was actually considered for the role of Woody Boyd in Cheers.
No kidding, Woody.
Yeah, which of course went on to become this massive hit and a role that could have drastically altered his career path.
These opportunities, even off the stand-up stage, clearly show that his comedic writing talent and his acting potential were still recognized and valued by major industry players. The Cheers role, in particular, highlights just how close he was to a different kind of mainstream success, one that could have placed him firmly within a traditional sitcom structure for, I mean, years. This makes you wonder, how did these almost moments shape a creative's path? And maybe even fuel a determination to forge their own unique way rather than fitting into pre-existing molds.
Yeah, that's a great point.
It suggests a strong internal compass guiding his artistic journey, prioritizing the creation of his vision over simply being a part of someone else's.
Which brings us right to a pivotal meeting and the turning point where everything started to coalesce. In 1987, Hodgson met Jim Mallon, who then became a production manager at St. Paul UHF station KTMA Channel 23 in 1988. And here's another choice that profoundly defines his path and vision. Hodgson was the first choice for Philo in the Weird Al Yankovic film UHF.
Right, Philo. The nerdy inventor guy.
Exactly. And for those unfamiliar, UHF refers to the ultra-high frequency broadcast band, often home to smaller, independent local TV stations. But by the time of filming in 1988, he had already begun production of a new form of television program for KTMA. He turned down a movie role, a potential mainstream acting gig, to pursue this new, unproven idea. That's real conviction.
That decision to prioritize his nascent project over a role in a Weird Al film, which was, you know, gaining significant traction at the time, it just underscores his unwavering commitment to his own unique vision and entrepreneurial spirit. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this period demonstrates how seemingly disparate skills, prop building, toy design, a deep understanding of absurd comedy, and a hands-on inventive sensibility all coalesced into what would become a truly groundbreaking television format. The fact that he was so dedicated to this new show, even before it was fully realized or had a guaranteed future, is a testament to his belief in the concept and his ability to see it through. This makes us consider, how does having diverse practical skills, particularly the ability to build and create physical objects, enable a creator to bypass traditional production hurdles and bring novel ideas to life? Ideas that might otherwise seem impossible within conventional studio systems.
Right. He didn't wait for permission.
Exactly. He wasn't waiting for someone else to make his vision happen. He was building it himself from the ground up, literally with his own hands.
And this brings us right to the creation of something truly groundbreaking, a cultural touchstone. Building on his incredible gift for designing toys and gizmos, all those skills from his sabbatical, Joel built three robot puppets and created Mystery Science Theater 3000, or MST3K, in 1988. From the workshop floor to the screen, his creative sabbatical was clearly foundational. It allowed him to integrate his diverse talents into a single, cohesive, and utterly original entertainment experience. Here's where it gets really interesting, as MST3K launches in 1988. Joel isn't just the creator. He stars as the show's long-suffering but inventive protagonist, Joel Robinson, who, in the backstory, is actually responsible for creating his own beloved robot companions, Tom Servo, Crow T Robot, and Gypsy. Such a simple yet brilliant premise, a man and his robots forced to watch bad movies in space, providing commentary.
Mm-hmm. This core concept of a lone human creating intelligent, sentient robot companions who then become his only family in isolation, it's absolutely central to the show's charm and its core narrative. It's a beautifully crafted isolation story that provides both humor and, well, a surprising amount of heart. Hodgson himself has cited the 1972 science fiction film Silent Running as a direct influence for the premise.
Silent Running, okay.
Yeah, which famously featured a lone human caretaker named Freeman Lowell, isolated in space aboard a greenhouse-carrying spaceship with only three robot drones, Huey, Dewey, and Louie, for companionship. This direct influence directly informs the isolated setting of MST3K's Satellite of Love and the deep, often hilarious bond between Joel Robinson and his bots. It gives the absurd premise of forced movie watching a surprisingly poignant anchor. It transforms what could be a sterile concept into a relatable human and robot experience of coping with a ridiculous situation.
A sci-fi film about environmental preservation as an influence for a comedy show about watching bad movies, that's just classic Joel Hodgson, isn't it? That unexpected connection. It's that blend of high-concept sci-fi and lowbrow humor, intellectual underpinnings, and pure silliness that really defines his genius and makes his work so enduringly unique.
Precisely. And the trajectory of the show's early life is just as remarkable. It highlights its immediate and undeniable appeal. MST3K originally aired on KTMA-TV, that local UHF station in St. Paul, Minnesota, which, by virtue of being a smaller independent station, often allowed for more experimental and grassroots programming.
Right, more freedom there.
Exactly. But it quickly leaped to national prominence. It became one of the first two shows picked up by the Comedy Channel, the forerunner of Comedy Central, upon its launch in 1989. This rapid transition from a local quirk to a brand new national cable channel speaks volumes about MST3K's inherent originality and its broad, immediate appeal. It wasn't just another show for the Comedy Channel. It was seen as foundational, helping to define the network's identity right from the start. It demonstrated that unique, low-budget creativity could indeed capture a national audience. And the fact that he also created and wrote Higgins Boys and Gruber, another sketch comedy program for the same network at the same time.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It highlights his prolific output and the creative trust that the network placed in him as a comedic powerhouse at that time.
So what does this all mean for the show's early impact? I mean, MST3K went from a local quirk to a national phenomenon almost overnight. It cemented its place in television history and really paved the way for a whole new genre of media commentary and interactive viewing experiences. It didn't just entertain. It taught an entire generation how to watch and critique films in a new, shared, and humorous way. It invited the audience to become part of the commentary themselves. I'm curious, do you think this rapid scaling from a local UHF station to a national cable network, was that a unique phenomenon for its time? Or did MST3K simply hit the right moment with its ingenious concept?
That's an excellent question. I'd say it was a confluence of both, really, a kind of perfect storm of timing and ingenious concept. The idea of shared comedic critique or riffing was undeniably ingenious and universal. It allowed people to feel part of a collective communal experience, right?
Totally.
But it also landed squarely in the fertile ground of cable television's expansion, particularly the Comedy Channel, which was actively seeking distinctive, identity-defining content, content that would stand out for the broadcast networks. MST3K's quirky, grassroots charm perfectly fit that niche. It demonstrated that a show could scale without losing its unique, homemade voice. It created a template for how a grassroots, inventive show could capture the imagination of an audience and then be scaled up to a national level without losing its unique charm.
Makes sense.
But as the show grew, Joel's personal role within it would, surprisingly, undergo a significant change, leading to one of the most talked-about moments in the show's history.
Right. In 1993, after 107 episodes, Joel Hodgson made a decision that surprised and frankly even saddened many fans at the time. He left MST3K after the episode titled Mitchell. It was a sudden and unexpected shift for a show that relied so heavily on his presence as the central human character. Fans were left wondering why their beloved host, the creator himself, would depart from what seemed like his perfect creative vehicle.
Yeah, it was a shock. And his departure was quite ingeniously scripted directly into the episode itself. It provided a narrative explanation for the character's exit and allowed for a, well, pretty seamless transition for the audience. In a memorable scene, the robot Gypsy mistakenly believed Joel's captors, Dr. Clayton Forrester and TV's Frank, were plotting to kill him. In an act of misguided loyalty and protection, she ejected Joel from the satellite of love in an escape pod, sending him back to Earth.
I remember that.
Yeah. This provided narrative closure for Joel Robinson, the character, while allowing for the show to continue without skipping a beat. Michael J. Nelson, one of the show's writers, then replaced Hodgson as host for the remainder of the series' original run, stepping into very big shoes indeed.
Initially, contemporary interviews suggested a pretty straightforward reason for his departure. Joel stated he was uncomfortable with acting and being in front of the camera, preferring to work behind the scenes in creation and production. It seemed like a natural move for someone who described himself as a maybe reluctant performer.
Right. But later interviews shed much more light on the complex, multi-layered reasons behind this pivotal decision. They revealed a deeper personal and creative struggle. In 1999, he revealed a more significant truth, stating that he and producer Jim Mallon had been, quote, fighting over creative control of MST3K.
Ah, okay. The classic creative differences.
Exactly. It's an unfortunately common challenge in many creative partnerships, particularly when a project grows from a small, local endeavor into something much larger, with increased stakes and different visions for its future.
He then explicitly stated that his departure, despite the personal cost and the appearance of not having other plans, allowed the show to continue without the internal conflict that was brewing behind the scenes. It also gave him the opportunity to focus on his preferred work, creation and production, rather than performing, which he admitted he did, only reluctantly. So it sounds like a very intentional choice to prioritize the health and integrity of the project and his own creative fulfillment over his personal screen presence.
It really does. And this raises an important question for any creative individual. Is creative control and the integrity of your vision more important than screen time or personal visibility? His decision unequivocally underscores his primary identity as a creator and a builder, someone who values the pure act of creation and the overall quality of the project above being the face of it. But what's truly fascinating here and adds immense emotional depth to his story is his reflection in 2008, years later. He openly admitted that leaving MST3K was a bit of a personal tragedy.
Oh, a personal tragedy.
Yeah. He confessed that he had created the appearance to the press that I had other plans, but I didn't. It was all to keep MST3K alive. He also profoundly felt his run on MST3K was the perfect job, revealing a profound and bittersweet personal connection to the show he had conceived and nurtured.
That's such a poignant detail, isn't it? To say it was a personal tragedy and that he had created the appearance of other plans just to keep the show going. It really highlights the depth of his commitment, not just to his creation, but to its continued existence, even at his own emotional expense. It wasn't about him, it was about the show.
It truly does. This nuanced perspective reveals the significant emotional toll of such a decision. The conflict with Mallon, as further elaborated in a separate 2008 interview, was clearly a key driver. He felt that the ongoing friction and disagreements over the show's direction could jeopardize the show and make it not a fun show to work on for everyone involved, potentially damaging the unique collaborative environment that made MST3K so special. He explicitly stated he believed leaving was the best thing at the time to preserve the show's integrity, its unique creative environment, and its ability to continue thriving for the fans. This speaks to a deeper commitment to the creative project itself, a willingness to sacrifice personal ambition or ego for the greater good of the work and the team. It demonstrates a profound sense of stewardship over his creation, prioritizing its survival and quality above all else.
So Joel's departure was not just an ending to a chapter, but a pivotal, almost sacrificial moment. It allowed him to step back, reevaluate, and ultimately explore new creative territories, ironically enriching his artistic journey even further by taking him down a different but equally inventive path. After his impactful and personally complex departure from MST3K, Joel didn't sit still for a moment. Not at all. He immediately embarked on a fascinating series of new projects, really showcasing his incredible versatility and his restless creative spirit. It wasn't a retreat from entertainment. It was a deliberate expansion into different forms and roles.
Absolutely. One of his first ventures was forming Visual Story Tools, or VST, with his brother, Jim Hodgson. Together, they created the TV wheel for HBO. Joel produced and hosted it. This was an incredibly forward-thinking, interactive sketch comedy program, an idea that was genuinely ahead of its time, pushing the boundaries of television engagement in a way that maybe viewers wouldn't fully grasp until the age of widespread internet and streaming.
Interactive TV back then, wow.
Yeah. It aimed to allow viewers to influence the direction of the comedy, an ambitious concept for network TV in the mid-90s. It aired only once, on Comedy Central, actually, after the last new Comedy Central episode of MST3K. Which is a testament to its experimental nature and perhaps the broadcast world not quite being ready for such innovative interactivity yet. What's also fascinating here is that Joel and his brother Jim maintained a side project called Jolly Filter, which involved repurposing movie footage with digital effects.
Oh, like remixes.
Exactly. That sounds remarkably like a precursor to much of today's meme culture, digital remixes, even deepfake technology, doesn't it? Long before these concepts were commonplace, they were already exploring manipulating media for creative and comedic purposes.
That's so true. It perfectly illustrates how he was always thinking ahead, looking for new ways to manipulate and interact with media for comedic effect. And his post-MST3K work also included significant writing contributions to a variety of shows and projects. It demonstrated his continued strength as a sharp joke craftsman and comedic mind across different genres. He wrote for the animated show Trashed, the Disney sequel Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves, the hugely popular trivia video game You Don't Know, Jack.
Love that game.
Me too. The late-night talk show Jimmy Kimmel Live, and the educational series Everything You Need to Know.
These diverse writing gigs highlight his adaptability and his ability to craft humor for vastly different formats and audiences, from family films to late-night quips to interactive game design. But he also made a memorable return to acting in a recurring role. In 1999, he played this uniquely quirky character, a disco-loving clothing store salesman and DJ.
Oh, yeah. On Freaks and Geeks?
Exactly. On the critically acclaimed television show Freaks and Geeks. It was such a specific offbeat role that perfectly fit his distinctive, understated comedic persona and showcased his ability to bring a memorable character to life, even in a supporting capacity.
He really has such a unique presence, even in smaller roles. What's particularly fascinating here are some of his truly unique creative contributions that show the breadth of his influence and how he continued to integrate his early passions. He was even the cover story in the November 1996 issue of Genie magazine.
Genie. The Magic Magazine.
Yeah, which is a highly respected publication for magicians. This brings him right back to his early magic roots and shows that he remained deeply respected within that community long after his stand-up days. That's a deep cut for fans of his original stage work.
It absolutely connects those early dots to his later career. It demonstrates a continuous thread of interest in illusion and performance. And his influence extended into the animated world, too, impacting a new wave of meta-comedy. In 1995, he wrote a season 2 episode of Space Ghost Coast to Coast titled Urges.
Oh, Space Ghost. Perfect fit.
Totally. An iconic Adult Swim show known for its surreal humor and deconstruction of the talk show format, which perfectly matched his metacomedic style. Then, the following year, Hodgson himself was interviewed in a Space Ghost episode titled $20.01, which famously parodied both MST3K, with its space isolation and commentary, and Stanley Kubrick's 2001. A Space Odyssey. These examples truly show his influence extending to other animated and metacomedic shows, demonstrating his direct impact on a whole new wave of creators experimenting with breaking the fourth wall and playing with media conventions.
And his voice became an instrument in itself for these projects. He lent his distinctive voice to Blackbeard the Pirate in The Radio Adventures of Dr. Floyd, a popular audio drama, and helmed his self-created puppet Dumpster Diver Dan for Frank Conniff's monthly comedy review, Cartoon Dump, again showcasing his puppet building and performing skills. And if that wasn't enough, he even starred in the sci-fi computer game Darkstar, the interactive movie as Scythe Commander Kane Cooper, an ambitious full-motion video game.
Oh, wow, FMV.
Yeah. His resume is just incredibly diverse, reflecting a relentless curiosity and willingness to jump into any creative medium.
It truly is.
Yeah.
Which raises an important question. How does a creator maintain their unique voice and artistic integrity while working on such a diverse array of projects across so many different media platforms? From animated shows to video games to puppet theater. It suggests a strong core comedic philosophy and a flexible creative approach that is remarkably adaptable. He isn't just a writer or an actor. He's an inventive force who finds a way to infuse his unique sensibility, that blend of wit, absurdity, and imaginative craftsmanship into whatever project he undertakes. His ability to adapt his signature style across these varied formats is a testament to the strength and originality of that core vision.
But despite all these varied endeavors, the call of movie riffing, his most famous invention, and the format he helped pioneer, it would soon bring him back. Back to his original collaborators and the specific type of shared comedic experience that defined him. The satellite of love in spirit was never really far away, was it?
Not at all. It felt inevitable somehow.
Okay, let's unpack this next chapter, which brings Joel full circle, really, to his most beloved creation. After years of diverse projects, Joel announced in 2007 that he was starting a new show with the familiar beloved premise of riffing on bad movies. It was called Cinematic Titanic. This wasn't just a new show. It was a significant reunion of familiar voices.
This was a truly significant reunion for fans, bringing together several fellow MST3K alumni, including Trace Bewley.
Crow, Dr. Forrester.
Exactly, J. Elvis Weinstein.
Tom Servo, Dr. Ariat.
Frank Onuf.
TV's Frank.
And Mary Jo Pell. The whole gang, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Or a big chunk of it. This demonstrates not only the enduring appeal of the riffing format itself, but also the strong creative bonds formed within the original MST3K team. It proved that the magic was in the collaboration as much as the concept. They didn't just record it, they performed live across the country, produced content for DVDs, and made it available via direct download. This showed a clear adaptability to emerging distribution models. This was before widespread streaming really took hold, and they were already experimenting with direct-to-fan delivery, bypassing traditional gatekeepers.
Smart move.
A testament to their innovative spirit and deep understanding of their audience's desires.
And Joel wasn't just directing this new venture. He was also directly engaging with his audience on a personal level. He toured a one-man show called Riffing Myself from 2012, detailing his life and career through slides, video, live interaction, giving fans a deeper, often introspective, look into his creative process and personal journey. That was before Cinematic Titanic completed its final tour on December 30, 2013. He really connected directly with the audience on a much more intimate, biographical level there.
That direct interaction with fans through Riffing Myself, it's key. It shows a creator who is constantly engaging with his audience, sharing his journey and evolving his relationship with them, turning his own life into a comedic narrative, essentially. But what's truly fascinating here, and perhaps one of the most significant developments in his career, is the unprecedented power of fan engagement to resurrect a beloved property entirely. On November 10th, 2015, Hodgson launched a Kickstarter campaign to bring back MST3K for another season.
The Kickstarter. I remember the buzz around that.
Huge buzz. It closed with over $6.3 million in funding, including add-on rewards. That allowed him to produce 14 brand new episodes. This wasn't just successful, it was a monumental achievement that demonstrated just how dedicated and passionately loyal the fan base was for its return. It completely reshaped the possibilities for how beloved niche entertainment properties could find new life through direct audience support.
And the project came to fruition, much to the delight of millions of fans. The new series was released on Netflix as Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Return, in April 2017. It starred comedian Jonah Ray as the new host, Jonah Heston, alongside the familiar original co-star robots Tom Servo, Crow, and Gypsy, continuing the tradition much like when Joel himself hosted. And for eagle-eyed fans of the original, Joel himself made a cameo appearance as Artie, hidden under a hazmat suit.
Right, Artie.
A fun, subtle nod to his past and a way to signal his involvement without taking center stage.
The series was met with mainly positive reviews, a testament to the enduring quality of the concept and its execution under new leadership. It proves that the format was robust enough to welcome a new human host. It also featured a nationwide live tour, MST3K Live, Watch Out for Snakes tour, which brought the experience directly to fans. Significantly, Hodgson was present for each show, marking his first time hosting in several years and his first time hosting alongside Jonah Ray.
That must have been cool to see.
Yeah, it ensured a crucial continuity of the beloved Joel presence, while also successfully introducing a new generation of fans to the concept. It created a bridge between the show's past and its future, maintaining that authentic connection that is so vital to such a beloved cult classic.
And here's where it gets even more interesting, because the story of MST3K's rebirth doesn't end there, not by a long shot. On April 7, 2021, Hodgson launched a second Kickstarter campaign for another revival of the series, this time for a new service he created called the Gizmoplex.
The Gizmoplex, his own platform.
Exactly, an entire online platform dedicated to the world of MST3K.
The initial $2 million goal for this second campaign was met within an astonishing 25 hours.
Wow.
Ultimately raising an incredible $6.5 million, an even higher sum than the first campaign. This unprecedented level of sustained direct fan support enabled the production of 13 new episodes, two of which would feature Hodgson himself reprising his iconic role as Joel Robinson.
Joel back in the jumpsuit.
Yes, as well as a 3D film and special Halloween and Christmas episodes. The consistent and even increased fan funding across these campaigns unequivocally underscores the deep loyalty and fervent desire for MST3K to continue thriving and evolving. This raises an important question for creators and media companies alike. How has crowdfunding truly reshaped the landscape for beloved niche entertainment properties, empowering creators and fans to directly finance and produce content in ways previously unimaginable by traditional studios?
It's a total game changer.
It really is. It's a powerful model for direct engagement and financial support that demonstrates the immense value of a dedicated fan base.
And the new season soft launched to Gizmoplex members on March 4, 2022, with the public premiere following on May 6, 2022. And crucially, to the immense joy of longtime fans, Joel Hodgson officially reprised his role as Joel Robinson in the season's sixth episode, Demon Squad, which premiered on June 24th, 2022.
Demon Squad, right.
That means it was his first time hosting an episode in 29 years. What an incredible full circle and deeply meaningful moment for him, for the show, and for the entire dedicated fan base.
It is truly remarkable. This return, facilitated entirely by the direct support of the fan base, is a testament to the enduring power of his original creation and his own unique personal connection with that audience. It goes beyond mere nostalgia. It speaks to the fundamental value of the shared experience he created. Joel's journey isn't just about reviving past glories. It's about a continuous evolution of his creative spirit, influencing new projects and generations, proving that a truly inventive idea, fostered with passion and adapted with ingenuity, can find new life across changing media landscapes, continuously engaging and growing its audience.
Beyond the monumental MST3K revivals, Joel Hodgson's influence and work continue to branch out in unexpected and often delightful ways, showing he was never content to simply rest on his laurels or be defined by just one creation. His creativity kept flowing, finding new outlets and new collaborators.
Indeed. His enduring respect within the comedy community was profoundly highlighted by his reunion with Jerry Seinfeld as a guest on his popular web series, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
Oh, I saw that one. It was great.
Yeah, it was fantastic. This wasn't just a casual chat. It was a conversation between two comedic titans, showing that even after all these years and their earlier collaboration, his peers still recognize and value his unique voice and significant contributions to comedy. They see him as a genuine innovator.
And for fans, there were more surprise appearances that delighted them. In 2013, he reprised his role as Joel Robinson for a brief, perfectly placed cameo in two episodes of Arrested Development's critically acclaimed fourth season.
Yes.
Alongside Trace Bewley, who also returned as Crow T Robot, it was a subtle, perfectly executed, and deeply appreciated nod to MST3K that fans absolutely adored, showing how ingrained his creations are in the pop culture consciousness.
What's truly fascinating here, and speaks volumes about his impact across generations and media, is his work on the Cartoon Network animated series Steven Universe. From 2013 to 2018, he voiced the recurring character Mayor Bill Dewey, the well-meaning but often bumbling mayor of Beach City.
Mayor Dewey, he was great.
He was. And here's the kicker, revealing the depth of his influence. Creator Rebecca Sugar, a lifelong fan of Mystery Science Theater 3000, personally cast Hodgson in the role.
No way. That's amazing.
Isn't it? This is a direct, undeniable testament to his profound influence on a new generation of creators, showing how his work shaped the artistic landscape and inspired those who grew up watching him. It's a clear, beautiful line of inspiration, from Joel's original vision to a modern animated classic.
That's incredible to have a creator who grew up watching your show then personally invite you to be part of their own creation. It really solidifies his legacy. And the homages continued. He also appeared in the Paul Feig-produced space comedy Other Space in 2015 as Zalian Fletcher.
Other Space, yeah.
Reuniting once again with Trace Bewley, who played his robot pal Art. That was a clear, loving homage to MST3K, directly recreating the human and robot in space dynamic that he pioneered.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, these diverse roles and appearances, whether live action, animated, or web-based, they demonstrate how Joel Hodgson's creative spirit and persona seamlessly integrate into modern media, continually finding new relevance. His distinctive voice, his comedic timing, and his underlying thoughtful, absurdist approach to humor are clearly valued across all these platforms. He doesn't just fit in. He elevates the material, bringing his unique brand of cleverness and heart to every project.
So what does all this mean for his enduring legacy? Joel Hodgson is more than just the creator of MST3K. He's a perpetual inventor, a master of creative adaptation, constantly exploring new ways to entertain, whether it's through hands-on puppetry, incisive writing, quirky acting, or fostering fan-driven revivals that literally fund the next chapter. He's a true visionary of shared interactive comedy.
Absolutely. And this raises an important question for all of us, particularly those who seek to innovate and build. In an era of constant information overload and fleeting trends, what makes a creative vision like Joel Hodgson's not only endure, but actually thrive and continue to inspire new generations of creators and audiences? Perhaps it's the fundamental joy of shared experience, the playful critique that invites participation, and the imaginative companionship he offers that resonates so deeply with the learner in all of us, reminding us that even the most obscure or bad content can be transformed into something truly special and enduring when shared with others in the spirit of intelligent humor and camaraderie.
We've taken a fascinating journey through the inventive and often surprising career of Joel Hodgson. From his early performances as a magician in Wisconsin, to creating television history with Mystery Science Theater 3000, navigating complex creative challenges, and then orchestrating ambitious fan-funded revivals that continue to this day. What stands out to you from this deep dive into his remarkable creative evolution and the principles that guided it?
Well, we've seen how his early influences, his willingness to take that creative sabbatical to explore diverse skills, and his profound decision to step away from the limelight to preserve his artistic vision, all contributed to a truly unique and enduring legacy. His story reminds us that the path of creativity isn't always a straight line, right? It's often a winding journey of exploration, collaboration, and constant reinvention. He's an exceptional example of how true innovation can find new forms and new audiences across decades, driven by a consistent, deeply personal creative philosophy.
For our provocative thought today, consider this. Joel Hodgson's career is really a masterclass in adapting a core creative concept, that joy of shared critique and imaginative companionship across decades and evolving media landscapes. He's continually found ways to bring his unique vision to life, whether through local TV, national cable, streaming giants like Netflix, or his very own fan-supported streaming platform, the Gizmoplex. So what enduring ideas or passions do you have that could be reimagined for new audiences or new platforms, much like Joel has continually done with Mystery Science Theater 3000? How can you take something you love with its unique essence and give it new life in unexpected ways? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep finding the humor in everything.